Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has fought in various aspects of that war over a distinguished career, initially in the United States Marine Corps, and more recently in the world of policy institutes for some years now at the Heritage Foundation, is our guest for this full hour. Is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marines retired. He is an extraordinary resource, not least because of his annual production at the Heritage Foundation of a simply superb resource document. It's entitled, in this case, the 2021 Index of U.S. Military Strength. And for, well, as long as I can remember, we've had the privilege of visiting with Dakota on the occasion of the publication of this important document, and we're always very grateful to him for his time, as well as the considerable expertise that he and his colleagues at the Heritage Foundation have brought to bear to give us this assessment of really our national security capabilities in a changing and, I'm afraid, increasingly dangerous world. Dakota Wood, it's very good to have you back, as always, and congratulations on the publication of the 2021 edition.
Thanks, Frank. I really appreciate the very kind words of support and encouragement on that. We have a great team that puts this together, you know, as you had mentioned, something like 24 authors, and just drawing on a great repository of expertise. And what we're trying to do, as you said here, is just convey to the American public, you know, how their tax monies are being spent, the condition of the military that keeps the country safe, and how the world changes, you know, over time. It's not a static place. And you know, these things build or decline over periods of time. We try to convey that in an easily readable, digestible format for the lay audience. And based on the feedback, I think we do a pretty good job with it.
Well, you do a superb job, is the point, really. And I, for one, find it indispensable year after year to get a, well, thoughtful, yes, but also accessible rendering of some of the complex issues that face our military and our national security more broadly. And I want to visit with you a little bit about a number of them in detail in the course of this hour.
Yeah, well, things that you've mentioned in the past, you know, in your own work and all that, is that context is important. And so when we talk about things like military power, you know, do you have a big enough army or air force or what have you? And it really depends on the nature of the world and the nature of your, you know, prospective opponents. Are they better or worse? And so it's that larger story that you're so great about telling as well, that, again, we try to convey so that when we talk about defense budgets or talk about a new airplane, how does it fit into that larger puzzle? And so that's the point of the index.
Yeah, well, thank you for the compliment, but back at you. This assessment in particular, as I think you've done now for each of them, starts with that context. It starts with the global operating environment, as you call it, and then gets into sort of the specific threats that we're facing from six different sources, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, what you call Afghanistan, Pakistan, and then non-state actors. We won't have time to do justice to all of this, but I have to say I was a little surprised that the operating environment was characterized as considerably more friendly, I guess is one word for it, that I might have characterized it as. Talk a little bit about your description of our operating conditions in Europe as favorable, in the Middle East as moderate, and in Asia most especially as favorable, Dakota Wood.
So we try to differentiate the environment differently or from the threats that you might go up against. So if the United States, for example, had to take action against Russian aggression, we were deploying forces into Europe. Well, when we think about Europe, does it have a lot of modern infrastructure? You know, does it have a series of treaty allies, which are more reliable, in a sense, than, you know, kind of a pickup team? Do our forces already have a presence? Have they been there before for a long time and know the area? So is it easier to work in that sort of thing than, let's say, when we had to deploy into Afghanistan? No infrastructure. You don't know anybody on the ground. It's a long way from anywhere. You have to invent stuff. You know, once you arrive, it's just more difficult. So when we viewed the operating environment, the U.S. has been in Europe since the end of World War II. We have extraordinary relationships with NATO allies, regardless of their individual levels of defense investments and capabilities. But yeah, we're there. We've got great infrastructure, rail lines and major airports and all those sorts of things. So in looking at this world, is it easy or difficult for U.S. military forces to deploy into an area and then to conduct operations? And that's a separate discussion than, again, the capability of the enemy that they might be operating against.
No, I get that. I get that. But I guess I'm just sort of struck by the fact that while all of that might be true, Dakota, I think it is true, the reliability of those allies under pressure, which presumably they would be if we were actually forced to, you know, come to their rescue again, may make that a lot less than favorable, even though those sort of conditions, as you've described them, would be so regarded as favorable in their own right. But let's talk about Asia, because obviously this is a very different kind of environment. Yes, there's a lot of advanced infrastructure, and yes, we have some treaty allies out there and so on. But it does seem to me that the operating environment is increasingly challenging to us, and characterizing it as favorable did come as a surprise, I have to say.
Well, again, differentiating between China and the political stability and infrastructure and relationships we have with friends and allies in the area. So in Japan, a very modern, robust economy, very great infrastructure. They've gotten very serious about their military capabilities, thinking about power projection instead of self-defense. Korea, South Korea, for all of its problems, still is fairly politically stable. You know, we've got a large presence there on the peninsula. And similarly, with relationships with other actors in the region, even with the Philippines, you know, it really dropped down and it's been improving over time. So I think the important thing for your listeners to know is that the index is not a futures document. We don't talk about what things might be 2 or 3 or 4 years from now. It's a report card on what occurred and how things developed and how conditions existed in the year 2020. So, you know, you finish the school year, you get your report card on how well you did during that academic year. And so the index is a report on the assessed year. And during the year 2020, you know, things were pretty good. It are also fair. I mean, the point that you made was spot on in terms of willingness to do things and our enemies are our friends reliable. And it's amazing how attitudes will change once people are pressed. You know, when you know, China's much more aggressive, well, we've seen some seriousness now on the part of Malaysia and Singapore and Japan and all that. And so I think in the offing of a potential combat situation, people will be much more willing to work with the United States than perhaps political rhetoric, you know, would indicate today.
Yeah, I'm not sure that South Korea falls into that category, but we can talk about that a bit more. But I'm also mindful of, you know, the prognosis of a fellow asked how he's doing, having fallen out of a building as he's passing the 15th floor. He's doing fine, but favorable may not be his condition shortly. We'll be right back with much more with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marines, retired, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting for this full hour with the editor of the 2021 Index of U.S. Military Strength, tremendous publication of the Heritage Foundation, where our guest works. He is senior fellow there, a senior research fellow for defense programs. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marines, retired. And during the course of his distinguished service in our country's military, he, among other things, served as a planner for operations like Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom. So when he talks about projecting power, infrastructure, and friendly allies and so on with whom to work, he knows whereof he speaks. He had to deal with some of the most challenging of our military operations in the country's history. Dakota, I wanted to talk with you, having sort of set the stage for this discussion of the threats with a little bit of a background on the operating environment, to focus really in on two in particular that I think we've not adequately appreciated, many of us, in terms of what they are doing to improve their capacity to threaten us. Let's start with communist China, which you characterize as aggressive rather than hostile in terms of the level of provocation of behavior, and as formidable with respect to the level of capability. Again, that seems to me to be a little charitable, or perhaps a little less than certainly predictive, but even taking, you know, into account all that the Chinese are up to, why isn't it hostile?
Well, that would be at the very top end. So if they actually started taking shots at U.S. forces, you know, and truly threatening U.S. facilities, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, if you've already pegged it at 10, how do you go to 11? So threats are intent and capability. You really can't discern intent. In a sense, you look at observed behavior. And so we look at China's behavior, how it's been investing in its military capabilities, its aggression in the South China Sea, you know, shouldering incidents with fishing fleets from other countries in the region, declaring, you know, no-fly zones, you know, there are defense identification zones. And it's just a very aggressive posture, but it falls short of open hostility.
So hostile is getting into an actual conflict with us.
Yeah, when you are actually mobilizing for military actions, and you know, it's an imminent sort of military threat, that's when we would ratchet it up to that top level. So China is short of that, because you need some room to talk about how things might worsen, and they certainly could. And then you look at the investments they're making in the military. I mean, they're going to launch their third aircraft carrier this year. They've made extraordinary investments in artificial intelligence in terms of its applicability to analyzing battlefield conditions. Fifth-generation aircraft are in production. They've gotten serious about power projection, you know, as opposed to internal stability, right, which is what the PLA was focused on for decades. So this is a...
And increasingly worldwide.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're seeing inroads into Latin America and Africa and elsewhere.
We're seeing hostile intent exhibited, I think it's fair to say, by the various capabilities that they're putting into place. And if the only thing that keeps them from being hostile for this purpose is they aren't actually using them against us in a kinetic sense, that may be a fair way to describe it. But I'm mindful of the importance of this book as a way for the average American to sort of evaluate the kind of environment we're in. And I wouldn't want them to take away from this that we're dealing with anything other than a very hostile China. In the normal sense of that word. Let's talk about Russia. Both of these countries are increasingly problematic in their own right. They're also seemingly increasingly in a strategic partnership that makes them even more worrying. Again, you've described Russia as aggressive in terms of the provocation of behavior level, and is formidable in terms of the level of capability. How does it differ from China in those regards? And talk a little bit about their strategic partnership too, if you would, Dakota.
Yeah, the partnership is opportunistic. Yeah, you know, they've got historical enmities that go back centuries. So I don't see a grand alliance, but they are certainly willing to cause problems for the United States and then to take advantage. You know, if the U.S. is focused on a China move, then Russia takes advantage of that. So complicating the United States security calculation benefits the both of them. And so, you know, two criminal cartels in a city could be causing problems for local law enforcement, but that doesn't mean that the two of them are actually friends. So I think, again, context is very important. But how Russia differs from China, Russia has just a small percentage of the economic throw weight that China does. It doesn't have a global presence market-wise and even increasingly military-wise as China does. Its surface fleet isn't in very good condition, but it is really invested in its submarine capabilities, hypervelocity, the sorts of weaponry, advanced fighter aircraft. Putin himself has talked about the importance of artificial intelligence. They have made strides in modernizing their nuclear weaponry, delivery capabilities. So, you know, they are not shrinking from the world stage. You know, it's a very formidable presence.
Militarily, and I think that's, of course, what the focus of your work is. You've mentioned several other threat vectors, the North Koreans, the Iranians, as I said, Afghan, Pakistan, and the non-state actors. We're going to have you come back and talk about those in some detail, if you would, Dakota. But let's look at what is your assessment of the status of our own military as we deal with these challenging, I think it's fair to say, and dynamic global operating conditions and increasingly dangerous adversaries. Let's start with the Army. You have described them as weak in terms of capacity, marginal in terms of capability, and yet very strong in terms of readiness for a net assessment of marginal. Give us a flavor of how you arrived at those various characterizations and their import for our security.
Yeah, so looking at the two big actors you mentioned, China and Russia, you can't say I'm only going to focus on China and do nothing to counter, you know, potential aggression from Russia. So the U.S. has to pay attention to several different theaters simultaneously. If you only have enough capacity to deal with one belligerent, then you leave all of your other interests uncovered. So what we did was we looked at the historical application of U.S. military power, the Army in this particular instance, of how much Army was needed for a major conflict. And that came up to about 20, 21 brigade, Army brigade equivalents. So when you look at the size of the Army today, if you want to be able to handle more than one fight, we assess that they need a total of 50 brigade combat teams. That would be the size or the capacity of the Army. Today, they only have 31. So they barely have enough to be able to handle a major contingency of some point and have something left over to handle either combat replacements, you know, from losses, or to do any kind of presence missions or reassure allies in some other region. So capacity, the size of the Army, is much too small, only about 70% of what the country needs. But with that small Army, the Army has paid a lot of attention to making sure that its current units are better in their individual readiness. So sending them out to training, getting more realistic training, going through the national training centers, et cetera. So they've made great improvements in the readiness of the small Army that we have. Equipment-wise, it's still old stuff. So you can't have variations in that, and that's what we tried to convey.
And this is a marked improvement, I think it's fair to say, from previous reports. I remember we used to bemoan the problems they were having with both old equipment and with the size and with the readiness. So to the extent...
Yeah, the Trump administration put a lot of emphasis on regaining readiness in the combat forces.
And to its credit. Let's turn to the Navy quickly, Dakota. We've got about 3 minutes before we have to take another break. Your sister service as a Marine, you have rated as weak in terms of capacity, marginal in terms of capability, and marginal in terms of readiness. Again, walk us through each of those, if you would.
Yeah, well, over half the Navy is greater than 20 years old. The ships are getting older at a rate faster than they're introducing new ships. We have fewer than 300, about 297 vessels, combat vessels in the surface fleet. And the Navy itself says it needs somewhere between 400 and 450. So, you know, 300 ships, the Chinese Navy has 350 alone. The U.S. Navy is only able to deploy about 60 ships on a daily basis into the Pacific. So you're already at a 6-to-1 disadvantage against a Navy like China. So capacity, it is really falling behind. And again, the ships are old. The crews have not had to think about conducting surface actions against an opposing fleet The last 20 years of operations has seen no naval opposition from any of the wars that we've been involved in. So readiness based on maintenance backlog, ship availability, the poor condition of naval shipyards has really put a burden on the U.S. Navy being ready for actions against a peer competitor.
And increasingly, those peer competitors have not only quantitative advantage over specifically, I'm thinking of the Chinese, but also qualitative parity, perhaps, or even exceeding some of those old ships.
Yeah, I think on a ship-by-ship basis and the weapon systems, we still have an advantage there, but that is rapidly closing. And the Chinese have gotten very, very serious about securing their lines of supply up into the Indian Ocean and the Middle East because of dependence on energy and getting access to markets. And so they're rapidly becoming up to a par with U.S.
Power projection globally that we talked about earlier is one of the hallmarks of this buildup by the Chinese Navy for sure, and further taxing our limited naval resources. Dakota, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to visit with you about the U.S. Air Force and your own service, the Marines. And touch on space, which is a new entry in the report this year for reasons that we'll discuss straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're doing an assessment of the state of the United States military and the challenges that it will face in the years ahead from forces that are hostile to us, and that's my term, at least, aggressive, and increasingly formidable in terms of their armaments, especially have been called peer competitors, which now include not only the Russians, but the Chinese. We're visiting for that purpose with the editor of the 2020 Index of U.S. Military Strength, retired Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Woods of the United States Marines. It is a Heritage Foundation publication. You can find it at heritage.org, and I commend it to you very highly. Dakota, so we've touched on the condition of the United States Army and Navy. Let's turn to the Air Force, and you've characterized it as marginal across the board, capacity, capability, and readiness. I know that one consideration, of course, is the age of our inventory of aircraft. Talk a little bit about that and what else is going into your calculation.
Well, I think the listeners would be shocked to know that the average age, meaning some are a lot older, even though we're bringing in new stuff, the average age of an Air Force fighter is 30 years old. I mean, who drives a 30-year-old car, right? And yet these are the kinds of aircraft that we would be sending into harm's way. You know, we're bringing the F-35 in. It's a great airplane, but limited in numbers. F-22s, probably 100 of them are usable on any given day. And then the bomber fleet is aged. Aerial refueling tankers, they average 50 years old. So it's a very old Air Force in terms of the equipment that it is using. The Air Force is trying to improve its readiness and had started increasing flight hours for pilots from a historic low, but in the last 2 years, that's been on a decline again. And this past year, the Air Force spent more on futures things, research and development programs, than it did on actually buying aircraft. And so you have to question, you know, where is the Air Force's focus on today's threats as opposed to threats that might materialize 10 years from now? So decreasing flight hours for pilots flying very old aircraft, and they seem to be distracted as a service on things that they would like to have 10 years from now, as opposed to ensuring that they actually win a war if we had to go to war in the coming months.
And going back to the point we talked about before, the qualitative comparison with some of these adversaries, it's particularly striking in terms of Chinese aircraft, the distinct similarity between them and some of our own, including some of the most modern of our own. Talk a little bit about the theft of our intellectual property and what that's done to enhance the quality of the Chinese military at a fraction of the cost. what we face.
Yeah, it's not just the cyber espionage that's going on, but it's Chinese students that are working at our universities, which provide a lot of the research that goes into that. They take that knowledge and bring it back home, working for very advanced companies. And you don't have to be riveting pieces of the aircraft together. It's the components, the software, the design that goes into some of these internal pieces in avionics and weapons designs. And so China is able to save billions of dollars of R&D funding, and they just take the knowledge and then produce the finished part. So there's some art.
And years faster, too. I mean, it allows leapfrogging.
Yeah, I mean, 10, 15, 20 years ahead. So they're just stealing American stuff. It informs their own organic design. So they're indigenously producing new things, but with the knowledge that they gained from stealing it from the United States.
And as that accumulates, obviously, it has a very distinct impact on the viability of our Air Force, for example, in going up against what will be larger numbers of Chinese aircraft and missiles and drones and other gear. Again, some of it ripped off from...
Yeah, and really enhancing national pride. I mean, if you're Chinese and you look at the state of your military and it can go toe-to-toe with the American military, the national will is increased, right? You feel more confident as a country and much more willing to do aggressive things. So there's a pile-on effect here of the conditions that you're talking about.
It's a formula for a lot more hostility in the future. I think there's no doubt about it. So let's talk about the Marines quickly. Again, your service and the one that I know you have particularly followed closely. You actually contributed the chapter on it. Talk a little bit about what seems to be its marginal rating across the board as well as the Air Force's.
So I'm a huge fan of the direction that General Berger, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, is headed in terms of preparing the Marine Corps for future conflict inside the weapons engagement capability of a large enemy like China. So you have to go smaller signature, smaller units, smaller footprint, and yet increase the lethality and the effectiveness of these smaller units. So it's a massive undertaking, the absolute right thing that needs to be done. But with flat budgets, potentially declining budgets, they're sacrificing capacity and sacrificing some of their modernization programs to be able to fund this. So when I was in the Marine Corps, we had 27 infantry battalions. Budget Control Act of 2001 dropped that to 24. They just couldn't afford them. Went all the way down to 21, rebuilt to 24. But now the Commandant has said that he's willing to shrink the Marine Corps again back down to 21. So, I mean, it's an increasingly smaller Marine Corps because of funding limitations, to have the people that you would really need to do. I accepted the Marine Corps' arguments that it's a one-war force. In previous editions of the index, it said based on historical use of Marine Corps forces in a major conflict, they need 36 battalions. And then all the supporting thing, squadrons and logistics and all those sorts of things, they need 36. And so we gave them a score based on that. Accepting the Marine Corps' point that they will never grow that big, I dropped the threshold to 30. But when you're at 24 battalions shrinking to 21, you're still too small. And if you take in, combat attrition, you just need more Marine Corps. Its equipment was purchased in the 1970s and 80s. They're making great efforts to introduce a new amphibious combat vehicle, and that seems to be on the right track. But the Commandant has also said that based on the exotic, very expensive nature of platforms like the F-35, they will likely reduce acquisition of that too. So it's just going to be a very small, well-trained, increased readiness sort of force, but I think it's just too small for the nature of the world.
But at the moment, the readiness is marginal as well. Are you seeing signs that's turning around, or is it going to remain that way for some time to come, do you think?
I think it's uncertain because they're trying to figure out what the new tactics are needing to be. And so in focusing on this transitional period, I think there's a lot of things that are up in the air. So we take the self-reporting statistics on flight hours, numbers of units that they assess as being combat ready, and don't try to deeply interpret that because we don't have access to the classified data. But the Marine Corps would like to be better in readiness in its squadrons, its aviation units, and its
infantry units and supporting arms that are up to speed in terms of the types of operations they think they're going to do. So they're reporting, we're getting better, but not quite there. And so we take that at face value and give them a marginal rating for readiness.
Let me turn finally to one of the new additions to this index, the Space Force. John Venable contributed a chapter on it. It doesn't have the same assessment, as it's, I guess, premature to make one, but talk a little bit about some of the most important aspects of our space capabilities, Dakota Wood, and just why it's important that we actually now have a Space Force in the mix of U.S. military strength.
Yeah, so the focus on space, space capabilities, utilization of space as an operating domain and how it supports so many other things was a subordinate function within the United States Air Force. So you had the missileers, cargo haulers, fighters and bombers, and the space component was just one of those things. But the increasing importance of space and the investment of countries like China in particular, Russia, even North Korea and others, said that we really need to have a separate service that prioritizes this as its sole mission and really professionalizes a force accordingly. And so they took all of the space capabilities out of the Air Force, formed a brand new service, and it's a year old. So, it just doesn't have enough longevity, a length period of service is a separate thing, defining what its metrics are. And so we didn't feel it appropriate at this time to give it an assessment, but it's a first good step. Now, there are still 20,000 other personnel in the Army and the Navy that also focus on space, and we think that those need to be drawn into the new service as well. That would just be the military services. You still have a larger space enterprise in the intelligence community that would also need to be accounted for as this thing matures over time.
I guess what you've just alluded to there is one of the things that explains something that surprised me, Dakota, and that is that our number of space launches in 2020 considerably exceeded both the Russians and Chinese, I think maybe even together. I had thought that we were improving. Obviously, these private companies that have begun giving us space launch capability again, including now manned space launch capability, are contributing, but that's a pretty stunning turnaround from where we've been heretofore.
An absolute explosion in the commercial sector. So when you look at the year 2020, 55 or so space launches in the United States compared with less than 40 from China and barely breaking 20 in Russia. So we've seen, the commercial United Launch Alliance some of the others. Yeah, exactly. SpaceX. SpaceX alone had 31, I believe, launches in the year 2020. And so they've done a remarkable job at having reliable, reusable launch vessels or vehicles, and then putting all sorts of satellite capabilities on top of that. So that's really the future. Great efficiencies and effectiveness out of the commercial sector, and this collaboration between private and public, I think, is what we're going to see more of in the coming years.
It's a very promising development and long overdue. It's decisive that we have access to space if we're to have any hope of exercising control over it, let alone protecting our interests there. Dakota, we have to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, retired United States Marines, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we have been visiting with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marines retired, now a senior research fellow with the Heritage Foundation and the editor of its superb annual product, the Index of U.S. Military Strength. The 2021 edition has just been published, and you can find it at heritage.org. I'm pleased that we have one more segment, because there's another very important topic that I wanted to cover with you, Dakota, and again, something of a surprise to me. Your characterization of the U.S. nuclear enterprise, our strategic nuclear forces, but also, you know, our labs and the industrial base and the readiness. On your chart, most of the categories are characterized as strong. A couple are marginal, and one, our nuclear test readiness, is weak. But I have to say, talk about how you arrived at that.
So we gave credit to the Trump administration's renewed focus on modernization and attention to nuclear weapons and supporting complexes. You know, the decision to move forward with development of new nuclear weapon capabilities was extraordinary, a very important a focus and a recognition that our labs had been falling into disrepair, that we needed to incentivize the attraction of new talent into that field. And so the last couple of years of that kind of focus has really borne some fruit, you know, that these authorizations, again, for new warhead designs and adaptation of various, you know, designs, a commitment to go back into the pit production, you know, the core there of a nuclear weapon. All of those were very good things. And remember, this is a report card on the assessed year of 2020. And we do caveat our comment about the status of the nuclear weapons complex by saying that these improvements will only remain in those green areas, provided you have a consistent focus in the coming years. So to your implied point, with the Biden administration coming in and the anti-nuclear bent amongst many of the policy advisors associated with that team, we are concerned what the next year's index and the one after that might herald. But, you know, the launch platforms are old. But again, like in the military services, there's been renewed emphasis on making sure that they're reliable and ready. And so in the year 2020, we were seeing the benefits of this focus by the Trump team on the nuclear weapons capabilities of the United States in the preceding couple of years.
I don't want to take anything away from that renewed emphasis, because I think it's been sorely lacking for years, as we've talked about in the reviews that you've done in the past. Dakota, I just, you know, going back to what you were saying about the Air Force and the focus on sort of its future projects rather than its actual capabilities at the moment and their adequacy, it would seem to me that applies in spades to our nuclear forces. Their actual condition is obsolescent. At best, it seems to me, pretty much across the board. We hope that we're keeping them fit, but you know, the warheads are ancient and not appropriate to the present missions or deterrent function, I don't think. And the industry, the complex that supports it is I think still in woeful disrepair. So I'm mostly concerned that as a user of this important report of yours, and a very, you know, strong devotee of the idea that it can be a resource for informing both elected officials and their constituents about, you know, where are we, that this may feed into the sense of complacency about our forces in the nuclear area, especially against the backdrop of what we touched on earlier, the massive buildup, the modernization. We've had Mark Schneider and Michaela Dodge, two of our colleagues, on in the program in recent days, just talking about, you know, the unbelievable investment and level of effort and modernization outcomes that have been accomplished by both the Russians and Chinese. And I very much fear that, particularly with the Biden administration coming in with its own predilections about nuclear forces, this could give us a kind of placebo effect of it's all okay. And I'm not sure it is.
Yeah, well, if listeners go to the website heritage.org/military, we've got some great graphics. And to your point, I mean, we've got a graphic in there that talks about nuclear delivery systems. You know, the B-52 introduced in the early 60s, the Minuteman III ICBM introduced in 1970, you know, the Ohio-class submarines, you know, their longevity, what they were planned for. So I'm not saying that everything is rosy, but in the year 2020, some really strong advances were made. Whether those continue in a Biden administration is a great question, and we're very concerned about that. But Michaela Dodge and Patty Jane Geller here at Heritage and others, you know, really talk with their colleagues in that industry, and we wanted to give credit where credit is due, you know, that these efforts need to continue. If they don't, then you will see a rapid decline, you know, into a weak category in our nuclear capabilities.
The guy is flying past the 15th floor, as far as I'm concerned. I'm afraid it doesn't end well. So let me ask you what one other somewhat more intangible thing, and maybe to give you a news peg to respond to, Dakota Wood. These comments by Representative Steve Cohen of Tennessee yesterday, in which he essentially, I think, demeaned a large number of military personnel by suggesting, in the case of the National Guard protecting the Capitol, that those who voted for Trump may not be reliable in performing their security functions. What do you make of that?
Well, the things that irritate me most are inconsistency, logical contradictions, hypocrisies, right? Especially from elected officials. So on the one hand, people will tout and glorify the military as the most trusted institution in the country. They praise waving the flag, everything we need to do for our men and women in uniform. And yet they come back then and talk about the over-militarization of policies, the untrustworthiness of National Guard units that have served the country honorably for, you know, two plus centuries, right? It's kind of like those that are gun control advocates who don't want the average citizen to have Second Amendment rights and be able to carry those kinds of things. And yet these are the people that have their own armed personal security guards, right? Defund the police movement. And yet when the political powers that D.C. view some kind of threat, have you seen how many police are in Washington, D.C.?
So nothing of National Guard.
Opportunistic. You know, absolutely. You know, so how can you say that trusted patriot defending the country, all we should do for our men and women in uniform on the one hand, and then be disparaging and skeptical and critical of the very force that you were praising just the other day? So, yeah, these kind of inconsistencies that damage the credibility of an elected official, and the American public should really hold with a lot of skepticism, you know, any of that sort of stuff. I mean, what do people know about their local National Guard unit, local law enforcement, you know, that live and work in those communities? And they're the good people, or are they trustworthy or not? And, you know, I think we just have to keep that kind of context in mind.
But let me ask the question a little differently. So what's the impact on esprit de corps and good order and discipline if they're watching this play out in the, you know, population of people who are supposedly supporting their backs?
So I think this is, comes to the professionalization of our force, right? The character of the individual, small unit leadership, and the behavior of more senior officers up that chain, right? So what you can do is use these situations, as some of our senior military has done, I think, quite effectively, in saying, when times are tough, this is where we step up and we exhibit the best behavior possible, right? You know, a law enforcement unit in some town, right, with all these defund the police units, and, you know, police are corrupt and police violence and all that other stuff. When does a community need more, right, or more in more need of trustworthy police? And so those who are in uniform, either in civilian law enforcement or the U.S. military, really need to see what is the greater good? You know, where can I can contribute? And it makes all the more important the service that they are providing. So I think small unit leadership, emphasizing these points, actually increases morale, you know, in that sense, you know, that we're doing things that need to be done, even when the country is in disarray, although that leadership needed because of these negative messages coming. So I would just hope that Americans look at those people like first responders that are doing what needs to be done for a greater good and a greater purpose, and that that buoys the spirits and moves them forward.
Well, we ought to be about it, needless to say, Dakota Wood, because for the reasons that we've just discussed, we're likely to need our military more than ever in the days ahead. It has to be fit. It has to be properly equipped. It has to be properly trained. And it all starts with those that we want to have serving in uniform being the best that we can provide as well. And that won't be the case if they're not properly respected and treated. So thank you for the great service you've provided, both in uniform yourself, Dakota Wood, and in your capacity as the lead author and editor of this important work, the 2020 Index of U.S. Military Strength. We always appreciate the chance to profile it here at Secure Freedom Radio, and look forward to talking with you often in the course of the year ahead. In the meantime, keep up the great work, my friend. I know you will. And to the rest of you, I hope that you will join us again tomorrow for more of this kind of informed conversation about the vital security interests of this country. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.